John F. Kennedy once said that, quote, the United States, as the world knows, will never start a war, close quote. After Bush's fear-mongering and Rumsfeld's shock and awe, and Abu Ghraib and Bagram and Guantanamo and secret renditions, how does Obama peddle his country all the way back to Camelot? Our own dear Gordon Brown's enthusiasm to hoover up the emails of the British people is another example of how Lord Blair's sick relationship with Bush still infects our own body politic. Only days before the wretched president finally departs from us, new U.S. legislation will ensure that citizens of his lickspittle British ally will no longer be able to visit America without special security clearance. Does Bush have any more surprises for us before January 20th? Indeed, could anything surprise us anymore? Obama has got to close Guantanamo. He's got to find a way of apologizing to the world for the crimes of his predecessor. Not an easy task for a man who must show pride in his country. But saying sorry is what, internationally, he will have to do if the change he has been promoting at home is to have any meaning outside America's borders. He will have to rethink and deconstruct the whole, quote, war on terror. He will have to get out of Iraq. He will have to call a halt to America's massive air bases in Iraq, its $600 million embassy. He will have to end the blood-caked airstrikes we are perpetrating in southern Afghanistan. Why, oh why, do we keep slaughtering wedding parties? And he will have to tell Israel a few home truths. That America can no longer remain uncritical in the face of Israeli army brutality and the colonization for Jews and Jews only on Arab land. Obama will have to stand up at last to the Israeli lobby. It is, in fact, an Israeli Likud party lobby, and withdraw Bush's 2004 acceptance of Israel's claim to a significant portion of the West Bank. U.S. officials will have to talk to Iranian officials, and Hamas officials for that matter. Obama will have to end U.S. strikes into Pakistan and Syria. Indeed, there's a growing concern among America's allies in the Middle East that the U.S. military has to be brought back under control. Indeed, that the real reason for General David Petraeus' original appointment in Iraq was less to organize the, quote, surge than it was to bring discipline back to the 150,000 soldiers and Marines whose mission and morals had become so warped by Bush's policies. There is some evidence, for example, that the 4-helicopter strike into Syria last month, which killed 8 people, was, if not a rogue operation, certainly not sanctioned by Washington or, indeed, by U.S. commanders in Baghdad. But Obama's not going to be able to make the break. He wants to draw down in Iraq in order to concentrate more firepower in Afghanistan. He's not going to take on the lobby in Washington, and he's not going to stop further Jewish colonization of the occupied territories or talk to Israel's enemies. With AIPAC supporter Rahm Emanuel as his new chief of staff, our man in the White House, as the Israeli daily Maariv called him this week, Obama will toe the line. And of course, there's a terrible thought that bin Laden, when he's not shopping at U.S. military post offices, may be planning another atrocity to welcome the Obama presidency. There's just one little problem, though, and that's the missing prisoners. Not the victims who have been, still are being, tortured in Guantanamo, but the thousands who have simply disappeared into U.S. custody, abroad or, with American help, into the prisons of U.S. allies. Some reports speak of 20,000 missing men, most of them Arabs, all of them Muslims. Where are they? Can they be freed now, or are they dead? If Obama finds that he is inheriting mass graves from George W. Bush, there will be a lot of apologizing to do. And that was, Obama has to pay for 8 years of Bush's delusions, by Robert Fisk, published November 8th, 2008, in the London Independent. Next, we're going to delve into the obstacle to change. To understand the relationship between Wall Street and the Pentagon, the permanent government, a self-selecting oligarchy, without whose approval no one may sit in the White House, and anyone who fails to do their bidding is gone or dead. Professor Peter Dale Scott has termed this unaccountable establishment the deep state. He was interviewed by Ken McDermott Rowe of History Counts.
Every 4 years, American voters have the opportunity to go to the polls to pick new national leaders. But does power really change hands? As we'll learn in today's program, since World War II, there's existed alongside our nominal democratic government a permanent and hidden power structure controlled by powerful economic interest that uses covert and sometimes illegal means to pursue its own agenda. Please stay tuned for this edition of History Counts, The Deep State. We're happy to have as our guest today Peter Dale Scott. We're going to discuss how the elite use covert power inside and outside of the government to advance their own agenda without regard to the democratic process. Professor Scott is a man of many talents, a poet, a diplomat, and a political researcher and writer. He served in the Canadian Diplomatic Service from 1957 to 1961, and he was professor of English at the University of California, Berkeley, until retiring in 1994. Professor Scott has written numerous political books, including The Road to 9/11, Deep Politics and the Death of JFK, Drugs, Oil, and War, and his most recent book, The War Conspiracy, published this year by Mary Farrell Foundation Press. His website is www.peterdalescott.net. Professor Scott, thanks very much for being with us today.
I'm happy to be with you.
In The Road to 9/11, you write about the ongoing tension that exists between the national security state, which you sometimes call the deep state, and the public state. Could you talk about that?
Yes, in every major power, but particularly it's apparent in America since World War II and the creation of the CIA, it was felt that the CIA, that America had to have powers dealing with the rest of the world that were not appropriate for close congressional surveillance. So essentially a group of lawyers and bankers in New York, Wall Street, like people will recognize some of the names like Alan Dulles and others from the past, Jim Forrestal, who became Secretary of the Navy. They decided in New York that America should have a CIA, and that was not enough. In fact, that could have, we wouldn't be talking about this if they hadn't then, from within CIA, created yet another organization, which many Americans still have never heard of, called the Office of Policy Coordination, or OPC, which was the beginning of dirty tricks. And it was given instructions to subvert the governments of other parts of the world, in effect, to break the law.
Now, the CIA really starts during World War II with Alan Dulles, who's a partner of Sullivan & Cromwell, the large Wall Street law firm, and a president of the Council on Foreign Relations. As president of the Council on Foreign Relations, they start pushing the idea that the intelligence group, the OSS, needs to be perpetuated. Is that right? And they start pushing for the establishment of a post-war CIA?
The key figure pushing was the head of OSS, General William Donovan. But the Council on Foreign Relations, they had these war peace studies groups, which was a very odd thing. It was part in the government, part out. People were participating from the State Department and the Defense Department. And meanwhile, but the meetings were essentially being chaired up in New York for the most part by members of the Council on Foreign Relations. And they were designing a whole structure for the post-war.
And Alan Dulles is tasked by James Forrestal, to come up with a charter for an organizational structure for the CIA. And Forrestal himself comes from a Wall Street investment bank, president of Dillon Reed.
And the interesting thing was that, of course, Alan Dulles was a Republican, but all of this was happening under Truman.
Well, Donovan was also a major New York lawyer. Donovan Leisure was his firm, a World War I hero. And the committee that Dulles organized to, you name the members of it, to set up the CIA, I noticed they're all private citizens. The managing partner of Dillon Reed, a representative of Brown Brothers Harriman, lawyers from the Wall Street firm Carter Ledger. Was there any congressional oversight?
Well, there was a sentence in the National Security Act which said that they would create a CIA to perform such functions as the National Security Council shall from time to time direct. That's not very specific legislation. If you look at the first of the deputy directors of the CIA that we know of the seven that we know, all were either New York lawyers or New York bankers.
And you also mentioned that the organization of the OPC, this covert operations group, was actually done at an investment bank. The meetings were held under Dulles with a committee of lawyers at an investment bank called J.H. Whitney, not at a congressional hearing.
The Congress had the chance to ask questions about the CIA when they passed the National Security Act. They had no chance whatsoever to say anything about OPC.
What was Operation Paper about, and who was Paul Helliwell?
But the original idea was that when the Chinese communists drove the Chinese nationalists out of China, most of them went to Taiwan, but a few of them took refuge in the eastern part of Burma, which is it's all tribes, they're not Burmese, and it was not under the control of Rangoon. And the decision, Operation Paper, was the decision made in Washington to supply and arm and build up those forces. The idea was that they would reinvade China, and they did actually once or twice go into Yunnan, were immediately repulsed. I don't think they tried very hard, because I think their bigger interest, these Chinese nationalist troops, was to build up a local drug traffic, because the KMT, which the party behind Chiang Kai-shek, had for decades financed itself from the drug trade, and it had also maintained its contacts with its party groups down in places like Bangkok or Jakarta or Saigon. All of it was through the drug trade.
Now, Paul Helliwell was, as you write about in your book, who was former OSS. He was a member of the CIA, the OPC. He was also, you say, a lawyer for Meyer Lansky's money laundering Miami National Bank.
Yes, but that's true. But before we get to it, we have to see that the OPC set up two proprietaries to help the Chinese nationalists. One was an airline. Its ultimate name was Air America, and everybody's heard about it. The other one was something called Sea Supply Inc., which was a company in Bangkok. They haven't heard about it. But they were working with the drug traffic, and the drug traffic profits were being invested by the underworld in banks. Now, Paul Helliwell was the officer in OPC who created both of those proprietaries that worked with the drug traffickers. But he was also, in public, a Miami lawyer, and he owned two banks, and at the beginning, he owned more later. But these two banks were being used by the CIA and OPC, and they were also being used by Meyer Lansky. It's not so surprising, because the funds that came out of Thailand, by the way, that opium was coming to the United States. It was a really shocking situation, and Lansky and the OPC were in bed together in Burma and in Thailand, and it was perfectly natural that they would be using the same banks.
Through the drug profits, were these operations essentially self-financing?
Well, everything in the Far East was self-financing.
And they were off the books, so there was no public record or counting?
Of course, I'm speculating here because no one has ever done me the favor of showing me the CIA's books.
Right.
But I think when we get to the scale of a 35,000-man army in Laos in the 1960s, then the Congress found out about that and held hearings into it and were complaining they'd never been told about it. So I assume that all of that was financed more by the drug traffic than it was, you know, that whatever input there was from the CIA's legitimate budget was minimal compared to what was happening. That was built up slowly but continuously from about 1950.
So the Laotian operation, this creation of a private army financed by the drug trade, that sort of was a continuation of Operation Paper?
Yes, it grew continuously out of Operation Paper. An intermediate stage, Donovan, you know, we were talking about before, was sent as ambassador to Thailand. And while he was there, the CIA had already helped set up some Thai border police, the idea being keep the communists out. But they were financing themselves from the drug trade. And then under Donovan, they set up, they had a CIA man set up an army which was designed not just to defend Thailand, but to attack, to go. They made contact with the people we call Hmong in Laos, and they also unseated the neutralist government in Laos and put in a right-wing government. They got very involved in Laotian politics in a way which produced, I really say it was the CIA first, then the North Vietnamese responded, and we got a war in Laos, which eventually blossomed into a full-fledged Vietnam War.
Now, this pattern of drug involvement, you say, continued more recently in the 1980s with the Mujahideen in Afghanistan?
There was a kind of scaling down in the 70s, and coincidentally, America's heroin epidemic also scaled down towards the end of the 1970s. But Zbigniew Brzezinski maneuvered us into Afghanistan, and that he actually boasted that what he was doing in Afghanistan drew the Russians into Afghanistan. So we had a reprise of what had happened before, only now it wasn't the Golden Triangle anymore, it was now the Golden Crescent, and a country which had not exported heroin before or even opium, or just used it locally, suddenly became a major heroin exporter. And today, of course, Afghanistan is responsible for 93% of the world's heroin.
And Vice President Bush was an important figure, the father of our current president, as far as these covert operations goes?
I'm not sure how much he was responsible for the drug part, but his office oversaw the operations in El Salvador, which were financing the Contras, and this Ilopango Air Force Base, once again, was also doubling of its 9 warehouses. I think 4 were for drugs and 5 were for the Contras, something like that. And on the case of Afghanistan, I think the key figure was really Reagan's director of Central Intelligence, Casey, William Casey, who was an old colleague of William Donovan's in OSS, the last of the OSS people.
Is it during this period that BCCI becomes important?
Yes, exactly. And BCCI is a Pakistani bank, the Bank of Credit and Commerce International, which was very buddy-buddy with William Casey. Casey didn't like the CIA. He was the head of the CIA, but he disliked most of the people in the CIA, thought they were too namby-pamby after the Watergate reforms, and he liked to deal directly with the head of BCCI, which was not just a bank. It was a drug laundering bank, and according to some books, a drug financing bank with its own covert operations staff. And Casey would meet one-on-one with the Abedi, the head of BCCI. And the fact that we got so involved with drug traffickers in Afghanistan, so that something like half of our aid in Afghanistan in the 1980s was going to a man called Gulbedin Hekmatyar, who at the time may have been the leading heroin trafficker in the world, that drug bias of our aid in Afghanistan can be a contributed, I think, to the fact that in the initial stages, BCCI was supplying the infrastructure, the shipping, the trucks, everything needed to get aid to the Mujahideen in Afghanistan. The same trucks were bringing the heroin back out.
Well, I'd like to move, if we can, from this discussion of the covert operations abroad to a discussion of covert operations at home. In your book, you present information indicating that for about 40 years, people inside and outside the government have been laying the groundwork for establishing a martial law state, which is now called the continuity of government. Could you talk about its origins in the Army's Operation Garden Plot during Vietnam?
Yes, well, continuity of government, which is COG for short, is a set of plans which have been worked on. They built on earlier plans for how to deal with an emergency. And initially, this planning was all how to deal with a nuclear emergency. But in the 1960s and 70s, when we had a great deal of protest against the war and about human rights, all kinds of issues in the 60s and 70s, you got a second kind of planning. Some of it in the state level, very advanced in the state of California under then-Governor Ronald Reagan. And then when Reagan became president, he took his director of emergency planning from California and made him head of FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency. And they started planning for continuity of government on a federal way. And two people who have been involved in that planning from the beginning, three people, this is where George H.W. Bush comes in. He was involved in that planning, and his gopher for doing little tricks here and there, Oliver North, Colonel North, was involved in the planning.
They called it a National Program Office, which sounds pretty innocuous.
Yes, it's always things like, you know, Office of Policy Coordination, National Program Office. Then there was yet another name after George W. Bush was elected.
When you discuss the Vietnam War era, the origins of it, you can see which direction it's going. I was interested to learn that the Pentagon established at that time in the 60s a Directorate of Disturbance Planning, and the headquarters for this organization, the Pentagon, was called the Domestic War Room.
Well, of course, you know, I don't blame it all on the Pentagon. They were dealing with a real crisis in the country. You know, Detroit went up in flames, and after Martin Luther King was assassinated, the city of Washington went up in flames. Well, Giuffrida, Reagan's emergency planning director, was a racist and a kind of a madman. He was thinking of rounding up blacks. Some people say by the million. That's hard to believe, but certainly in very large numbers.
Well, really, it was also tied into the FBI's COINTEL group, where agent provocateurs would infiltrate groups.
Right, and Army intelligence was in on the picture. And in those days, the CIA was in with their what they called Operation Chaos in the 70s. They ostensibly, they were doing surveillance on domestic groups. But when you get informants, when you plant informants in groups, and their success rate depends on having good news, those people almost always become provocateurs. Whether or not they were sent to be provocateurs, that's what they become. And I had personal experience of this when I was in the anti-war movement in the 1970s and later.
As the program matured in the Reagan administration, President Reagan actually assigned an executive order which called for the suspension of the Constitution under certain circumstances?
I could only deal with that by saying that very question was asked of Colonel North in the Iran-Contra hearings with an amazing response. And the response didn't come from Colonel North. It came from the chairman of the Iran-Contra committee hearing, who was a Democrat, Senator Inouye. He banged his gavel and he said, "We can't go into that in a public session." Which meaning, and really admitting that there were plans for the suspension of the Constitution. And there are two books about that planning, one by James Mann and one by James Bamford, and both of them have spoken to a veteran of the planning who said, well, we were if we're dealing with an emergency, what would the role of Congress be? And they, the people doing the planning said, well, it's just too complicated to bring in Congress, so we'll just plan for a government without them. So that in itself would be a suspension of the American Constitution.
And you note that people who were important in working on the continuity of government plans under the Reagan administration, including Donald Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney, then end up as important officials in the Bush Jr. administration.
That is correct. And the astonishing thing is that Cheney and Rumsfeld have been in on this planning from the very beginning and continuously through the 1980s when Rumsfeld wasn't in the government at all. He was the chairman of a drug company, G.D. Searle. And then through the 1990s, when neither Cheney nor Rumsfeld were in the government, because Cheney became the chairman of Halliburton, but they continued to plan for COG. And let's be very clear about this, because a lot of people don't understand it, that COG was implemented on September the 11th, 2001. We don't know what that means. We don't know if it was just a little bit of COG or if it was a great deal of COG, but I think it's pretty clear from what's happened since that three elements which had already become clear in the 1980s were actually instituted after 9/11. And the first is warrantless surveillance, and there's been a lot of talk about that since. Another, about which there's not been enough talk, is warrantless detention, the suspension of habeas corpus. That happened right away for a number of Muslims in this country, and it's happened for other people, and I wrote an article about how Halliburton, KBR, actually, I should say, Cheney's old company, got a contract, almost $400 million contract, to build detention centers in this country for people who were being rounded up without a warrant. And then the final thing, which is definitely has happened and in such a large way we almost don't notice it, is the preparation for martial law. And they have created a military command now for North America, and they have begun to accustom us for the use of the Army in civilian ways.
This is the Northern Command?
NORTHCOM, yes.
NORTHCOM, yes.
You have a South Command, you're right, it is the Northern Command.
That's the first time we've had such a command within the United States.
Within the United States, and actually this affects Canada too, because Canada has always had a Canada command, but the head of NORTHCOM and the head of CanadaCOM signed an agreement, a military agreement, allowing for the forces of one to go into the country of the other, and this has had quite a major impact on Canada because now American submarines are going into Canadian territorial waters and they can say, well, there's this agreement.
And I understand that the Northern Command, which was, I think, basically a staff operation, was just recently assigned a regular combat infantry brigade, and that brigade is presently being trained in tactics of suppressing civil disorder, including the use of tasers.
Right, and another thing which is the kind of people who listen to this show should be aware of, that they have had been conducting war games, and as far as we can make out, according to Associated Press, they mounted a war game, Operation CyberCom, which was against bloggers, because one very clearly, if there is a martial law declared in this country, then the whole status of the internet will, freedom of speech on the internet will be radically impacted, and they have had war games on how to deal with bloggers or with what Rumsfeld called people like me, and I'm probably, there are a lot of bloggers listening to this show, and they have plans to deal with bloggers. They have rehearsed them in war games.
What can people do to try to reassert control over the public sphere in the United States?
Well, I think they have to activate the Democratic Party to be more upset about this than they are now. And a good test of this was in 2007 when Bush renewed the state of emergency that had been proclaimed in September 2001. And he did in a document which had secret annexes about providing for continuity of government. And Congressman Peter DeFazio from Oregon said, I would like to see those annexes. He's on the House Homeland Security Committee. And he was told he didn't have the clearance to see them. So then the entire House Homeland Security Committee, Republicans and Democrats, said that they wanted to review these documents. Let's not forget that they had been described back in the 80s as plans for the suspension of the Constitution. And you would think, as long as we have checks and balances in this country, that Congress should review any plans which call for the suspension of the Constitution. They were told in writing they could not see those plans.
I've heard you also talk about the need to create new alternate institutions which are independent of the state. Could you talk about that?
Well, I think that we're in politics are important and everyone should get out and vote in November. But politics today, party politics, isn't offering an alternative to this drift into deep state government that I've been talking about. We have to build our own institutions. I'm not calling for outright violent revolution here. I'm calling for building institutions which will have the power eventually, they wouldn't at first, to challenge this whole fabric of government in which the big issues like the deep state are not being discussed at all. And so I point to the example of Poland, where they planned for 20 years to get rid of the Soviet army, and by golly, they did, within the Solidarity Movement. And the leader of it said, that you had to change people's minds, and it took 15 or 20 years to do this. John Adams said the same thing about the American Revolution. He said it wasn't the war. The war came in when the revolution had succeeded, when the revolution was changing people's minds, and that was, I think, Adams said it was 20 years, and Michnik said it took 15, but it's the same idea that when your established institutions aren't serving their purpose, you have to build new ones to reorient the direction of government.
Well, thanks very much for joining us today, Professor Scott. You're listening to History Counts, and we've been talking about covert operations and their impact on democracy with Professor Peter Dale Scott, author of The Road to 9/11. His latest book is The War Conspiracy. You can find Professor Scott's website at
www.peterdalescott.net.
And we'll also put a link to it at historycounts.org. While today's program concerned covert operations, there are also many overt ways in which the wealthy influence democracy. For example, corporate ownership and sponsorship of the media, through which public discourse can be controlled, a campaign finance system that relies on large infusions of private money, extensive lobbying operations that give the wealthy preferred access to elected officials, and the selection of important government policy officials from the ranks of powerful corporations. With respect to the last, consider the influence of just one bank, Goldman Sachs. Robert Rubin, Goldman's chief operation officer, became Treasury Secretary under Bill Clinton. Hank Paulson, Goldman's chairman, became Treasury Secretary under the second President Bush. Robert Zoellick, the Bush administration's top trade official, became a Goldman managing director before taking his next job as head of the World Bank. And Stephen Friedman, former head of Goldman, chairs the President's Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board, whose 16 members consist largely of private citizens from influential banks, law firms, and industries, including oil. Meanwhile, Mr. Friedman still sits on the Goldman board. Please visit us at historycounts.org, where you can listen for free to an archive of our programs. Until next time, this is Ken McDermott Rowe for History Counts.
Alex was a member of my record label, teenager though he is. He joined every vile records in the indie music biz. His parents didn't like such turns of events, so they called up a couple of thugs, send him back to Utah, lock him up, and pump him full of drugs. They say he's got problems with authority. Yeah, this is what they claim. And their psychiatric analysis has even got a name. Oppositional defiance disorder. I think I got it too. oppositional defiant disorder. He's sick and so are you. If you think George Bush is a moron and Tony Blair's a liar, if you fantasize about setting your local Walmart on fire, if you don't like Tom Brokaw and you think he's full of it, if you feel a Rush Limbaugh punching bag might be kind of fun to hit, if bombing other countries makes you feel appalled, you have got a problem, and this is what it's called: oppositional defiance disorder. I think I got it too. Oppositional defiance disorder. He's sick and so are you. If you think school is boring and your teacher is a fool, if you don't like your congressman and you call him a corporate tool, if you were not standing to sing Save the Queen, if you turned down hamburgers and ate rice and beans, we've got a diagnosis no matter whether you agree. Just do what the doctor tells you. Thank God for psychiatry. Oppositional defiance disorder. I think I got it too. Oppositional defiance disorder. He's sick and so are you.
We'll conclude the show with our next installment of the serial reading from the book Power and Powerlessness by Dr. Susan Rosenthal. As we continue in Chapter 12, examining the education system and how the template of domination operates on the individual level with Bullying 101. Bullying 101. A 1998 survey of more than 15,500 public and private schools in the grades 6 through 10, found that 40% of boys and 30% of girls had been bullied in school. About half of the boys and one-third of the girls reported that they bullied others. Most were bullies and victims at different times. Why is bullying so common among young people? Children learn by mimicking adults. Schoolyard bullying fits in with a world where might makes right, regardless of what adults say. In response to the 1999 shooting at Columbine High School, President Bill Clinton pleaded on national television, "We must teach our children to resolve their differences with words, not weapons." While the president was preaching nonviolence, the U.S. military was bombing Yugoslavia. Children are keen observers, and they copy what adults do. In 2002, a bystander videotaped four police officers beat a handcuffed black teenager, drag him along the ground, and slam him against a police car. What provoked this savage attack? 16-year-old Donovan Jackson was slightly built and had hearing and speech problems. It seems that the officers became enraged when the youngster did not respond quickly enough to their verbal commands. Actions speak louder than words. A do-as-I-say-not-as-I-do model of behavior establishes two standards, one for those with more power and a different one for those with less power. The lesson is not lost on children who practice the three roles of powerful persecutor, helpless victim, and passive bystander. These roles are acted out at home when parents attack each other and children feel helpless to intervene. When a parent singles out one child for punishment and forces the rest to watch. And when a parent punishes a child over the protests of the other parent. In the classroom, the teacher humiliates one student to discipline them all. In the workplace, management targets a few workers to control the rest. On a world scale, stronger nations destroy weaker ones to demonstrate their power. Schoolyard bullying is a copycat response to the bullying that saturates the child's world. The most effective response to bullying is for people to unite against it. schools don't want youngsters learning this lesson. Eighth grader Anthony Soltero stood up to the bullies in March of 2006 when he helped to organize a student walkout in Los Angeles to protest anti-immigrant legislation. After the march, the school administrator threatened to send Anthony to jail for 3 years and fine his mother $250. In despair, Anthony killed himself. To honor Soltero's commitment to justice, LA students organized another march for immigrant rights and called on students across the country to do the same. Winners and losers. I'm the king of the castle and you're the dirty rascal. Every child has proudly chanted this ditty on top of the tallest mound and has also been humiliated by someone else who got there first. Through games and chants, preschool children prepare for a world of competition. As soon as they enter school, they are immersed in win-lose situations. By means of tests, contests, games, and sports, teachers evaluate, rank, and sort youngsters, advancing the winners and degrading the losers. Schools hold out the promise that hard work will be rewarded, but win-lose competitions teach children otherwise. My 6-year-old grandson loves to spell, and he works hard at it. One day he came home from school dejected. He had spelled 2 words wrong and was denied a gold star. His mother reassured him, but he remained sullen. After dinner, he hit his sister. When reprimanded, he began to howl and would not be consoled. Children have an innate sense of fairness and know when promises are not kept. It's not fair. My grandson was learning that hard work counts only when it results in perfection. There is no recognition for hard work or for learning through trial and error. He was treated like a loser, and that made him angry. As Oliver observed, you feel mad, so you take it out on other people. Schools produce bored and angry children. When adults reward the efforts of only a few children, those who see their efforts ignored or belittled lose interest in learning. Children who cannot win at school will compensate by trying to win the recognition of their peers, often by defying the system that is excluding and humiliating them. Uncooperative and misbehaving children are like red flags that signal serious social problems. When children have problems with school, teachers and parents are blamed. Teachers are squeezed between the needs of their students and the demands of the administration. If they provide engaging opportunities for children to learn, they are disciplined for not following the curriculum. If they impose the curriculum, they become the enemies of the students. Parents are treated like extensions of the school. They are supposed to make their children do homework and provide extra support for those who fall behind. When children rebel, parents are pressured to give them drugs to make them more compliant. Say yes to our drugs. The school system neglects, oppresses, and humiliates children, then labels those who rebel as sick or defective. The Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, DSM, considers child rebellion to be a sign of mental illness. Conduct disorder and oppositional defiant disorder are psychiatric diagnoses listed under the category of disruptive behavior disorders. The following study exposed how absurd these diagnoses are. In North Carolina, a gambling casino opened midway through an 8-year study of child psychiatric illness. Because the casino was owned by the First Nations, it paid each Aboriginal family a financial bonus that rose every year. These payments elevated 14% of the families out of poverty, while 53% remained poor. 32% of the families were not poor to begin with. Before the casino opened, the poor children had more than 4 times as many psychiatric symptoms as the children who had never been poor. After the casino opened, psychiatric symptoms among children who were no longer poor fell to the same level as children who had never been poor. In contrast, psychiatric symptoms remained high among the children who remained poor. Similar results were found in non-Aboriginal children whose families moved out of poverty during the same period. Why would rising income levels solve child behavior problems? Chapter 7 explained that all children have difficulty regulating emotions. At times, all children are impulsive, hyperactive, aggressive, and defiant. Supportive adults must teach children how to manage their feelings. Deprived and overly stressed parents cannot do this. The resulting child misbehavior signals a crisis in the family. Money does not solve all family problems. However, it can meet enough of the parents' needs so that they, in turn, can meet their children's needs. Unfortunately, society refuses to support families and drugs kids instead. Cuts in funding for education, family support, and child services have led to an escalation in the number of children being prescribed psychiatric drugs. The psychiatric diagnosis of attention deficit disorder, ADD, also called attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, ADHD, was created to permit doctors to drug children who act out in school. Drug prescriptions for school-aged children peak in September and drop in June, the duration of the school year. One program offered an alternative to drug treatment. A trained social worker met weekly at home and at school with the child diagnosed with ADD and their parents. While they were participating in this program, none of the children needed medication. When funding for the program ended, all the children began to have problems and went back on medication. The drugs most commonly prescribed for ADD are powerful stimulants, like amphetamines and Ritalin. According to the U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration, quote, "In clinical studies, neither humans nor animals can tell the difference between cocaine, amphetamine, or methylphenidate when they are administered in the same way at comparable doses. In short, they produce effects that are nearly identical." Close quote. Between 1991 and 1999, U.S. production of amphetamines increased more than 2,000%, and sales of methylphenidate, Ritalin, increased nearly 500%. About 80% of all prescriptions for these drugs are for children diagnosed with ADD. In some areas, 1 in 4 school children is taking these drugs. Twice as many boys are given drugs for ADD compared with girls, who are more likely to be given antidepressants. Every year, an estimated 500,000 American children are prescribed antidepressant drugs. A national survey found that increasing numbers of children are also being prescribed antipsychotic drugs that have been linked with serious health problems. In 1993, 275 children out of 100,000 were taking these drugs. By 2002, the number had risen to 1,438 out of every 100,000 children. While politicians call for a drug-free America, the nation's children are being drugged at an unprecedented rate. The American Academy of Pediatrics estimates that between 4 and 12% of school-aged children suffer from ADD. It is more likely that politicians and bureaucrats are afflicted with ADD because they pay no attention to the harm caused by their slash-and-burn social policies. In contrast, children are fully aware of their suffering, and they protest it in the only ways they can, with anger, agitation, anxiety, depression, and defiance. Who hears the cries of our children? Teachers are tied to a restrictive curriculum and deprived of resources. Doctors prescribe drugs instead of protesting oppressive conditions. Courts force children to take mood-altering drugs. Parents who refuse to medicate their kids have been charged with child abuse and threatened with losing custody. When medication fails, there is always punishment. school as prison. We are breeding a generation of children who think they are criminals for the way they are being treated in school. School used to be a refuge. Now it's a lockdown environment. We are bringing the practice of criminal justice into the schools. Annette Fuentes. Today's youngsters are being criminalized by policies of zero tolerance in schools. Making mistakes is human and unavoidable, especially during adolescence, which is a time to explore and experiment. By forcing youngsters into behavioral straitjackets, zero tolerance policies invite rebellion, beginning a cycle of punishment and defiance that turns children into criminals. Students in Texas can be suspended for, quote, cheating, violating dress codes, horseplay, excessive noise, and failure to bring homework to class, close quote. Because student suspensions are reported to the County Juvenile Justice Board, a child could be saddled with a criminal record for being rowdy. In 2003, journalist Annette Fuentes investigated the impact of zero-tolerance policies in public schools. Every year, more than 3 million students are suspended, and nearly 100,000 more are expelled from kindergarten through 12th grade. Of those, untold thousands face police action for disciplinary problems that were previously handled in school, because 41 states now require that certain acts committed in school be reported to the police, close quote. Boys are the primary targets, and black males are singled out. Even though they do not break the rules more often, 2 to 3 times more black students than white students are suspended from school. African American students are 17% of the entire public school population, but account for 34% of all out-of-school suspensions and 30% of expulsions. White students, by contrast, are 62% of the student population, but account for 48% of out-of-school suspensions and 49% of expulsions. Zero-tolerance policies are enforced by police, police dogs, and metal detectors in schools that feel like prisons. Public officials insist that such heavy-handedness is necessary to prevent youth crime. In fact, rates of school violence are much lower now than when the parents of today's youth were in school. There is only a 1 in 2 million chance of anyone being killed at school. 75% of all murders of youngsters under age 18 are committed by adults. One would never know this from the media. And I'm reading from Power and Powerlessness by Susan Rosenthal. Demonizing youth. Portraying youngsters as criminals helps to justify more police, more prisons, and more social control. In 1995, John DeLulio of Princeton University wrote, The Coming of Super Predators, in which he predicted the rise of an especially violent type of juvenile criminal. In 1996, Bill Bennett, co-chair of the Council on Crime in America, predicted that, quote, America is a ticking, violent crime bomb. Rates of violent juvenile crime and weapons offenses have been increasing dramatically, and by the year 2000 could spiral out of control, close quote. In 1997, Florida Congressman William McCollum stated that today's youth are, quote, the most dangerous criminals on the face of the earth. The facts said otherwise. Crimes committed by young people had been falling for years. According to FBI statistics, in 1999, the year of the Columbine High School shooting, incidents of school violence and juvenile violent crime had hit their lowest level in 20 years. There had been an increase in youth embezzlement. Perhaps DeLulio should have titled his report, The Coming of the Super Embezzlers, but people might have thought he was referring to corporate America. In The Myth of the Grade School Murderer, Mike Males provides the following statistics, quote, In raw numbers, about 60 grade school kids were arrested every year for homicide during the 1960s, 70 per year during the 1970s, 40 per year in the 1980s and 1990s, and just 22 in 1998 and 17 in 1999. A grade school child was arrested for murder once a week on average in the halcyon days of 1965, when Father Knows Best and I Want to Hold Your Hand ruled the airwaves. Today, when ultra-violent video games, slasher movies, gangster rap, explicit TV, internet savagery, more poverty and family disarray, and automatic firearms are rampant, grade school kids are 65% less likely to murder, close quote. Despite the facts, the mainstream media revel in the image of youngsters as dangerous criminals. A group of New York high school students studied the New York Times coverage of youth and crime. They found that over a three-month period, 54% of articles portrayed youth as perpetrators of crimes, and 44% portrayed them as victims of crime. A study of the San Francisco Chronicle found that stories on youth and crime portrayed youth as perpetrators almost 75% of the time. The hype against youngsters is so effective that when people hear the words youth and violence, they think of youth as violence, not as victims of violence. Test this yourself. In reality, young people are victims of violent crime more than 12 times more often than they are perpetrators. The media all but ignores the estimated 2,000 deaths and 475,000 incidents of violence that adults inflict on youngsters every year. What about teen drug abuse? Adults suffer far more drug abuse and addiction than young people. 80% of drug overdose deaths occur in people over 30 years of age. Fewer than 3% of these deaths occur in people under age 20. Today's 40-year-olds are three times more likely to suffer serious illegal drug abuse problems than today's 16-year-olds. Males concludes, quote, "Nearly all the imagined youth crises of today, from guns to heroin to suicide, are hallucinations. The fastest growing population in terms of drug abuse, criminal arrest for violent property and drug offenses, and imprisonment is persons aged 35 to 59, mostly white. Teens comprise perhaps 2% of America's drug problem, but 90% of the raging controversy over drug use. That is scapegoating." Close quote. The flood of negative hype against youngsters has an impact. A 1999 survey found that most adults in the United States have disapproving and negative attitudes toward teenagers, and most believe that the next generation will not make the world a better place. By demonizing young people, the ruling class drives a wedge between the generations. When people lose faith in the future, they resign themselves to the way things are. I've been reading from the book Power and Powerlessness by Dr. Susan Rosenthal, published in 2006. We'll continue with the reading next week. In the meantime, you can obtain the entire book in various ways through the author's website at susanrosenthal.com. Over the coming weeks, we'll be reading the book together, and at the end, I'll be interviewing Dr. Rosenthal and asking her my questions and yours. If you have questions and comments about the book you'd like her to respond to during the interview, please email them to me at the email link on the Unwelcome Guests website at unwelcomeguests.org, where MP3 downloads of this and all previous episodes are also available. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you for listening.
You still catch me napping one day and they'll kill me. Then I'll be gone, but that won't be my end. For me. my guns and my saddle will always be filled by unwelcome.